Okay, maybe we can just get started and let's let Professor Clark say a few words.
Yeah, I'd like to say that I appreciate the chance to talk first, because probably it's not deserved, but so many of you have spent so much time on Professor Gibson's views. I have a lot of questions, which seems to me to indicate how very interesting what you say is. Let me just start with some, and they may be of interest and be picked up, or they can be dropped. You talk about perception as visual perception as sampling our environment. And one trivial kind of point seems to be suggested by this, that to sample our environment and to detect constancies means that we have to, as it were, detect something at, as it were, one taking. At one taking. So if I am to see that this is an invariant across a transformation, I must discriminate and detect something sort of at one point. So I want to ask whether there is not perception in your sense, but which does not involve the sequential sampling, namely which is required as presupposed by your view of the sequential sampling of our ambient visual environment.
If I understand, you're asking, yeah, how do I explain how well we can perceive with a flash to histoscopic exposure, or with a picture, fluorescent picture?
Can I back up just a bit from that? I'm asking, would such an experience constitute a perception for you, as you understand perception?
Yes.
Yes, okay, fine, as well. I'm going to jump, if I may, we can come back to follow up, but I thought it'd be better to try to get out a group of two or three questions first. Philosophical question. Suppose someone said, this isn't realism at all. In place of the old intermediate objects between us and what we think, Gibson has now introduced samplings of the ambient array, and the sequence of such samplings is the intermediate object from which we form our thoughts about things that we ordinarily say we see, like ashtrays.
Answer quick to that. Well, I don't think they're entities. There's, you're getting me in trouble, I know, because the first question, the second question, I don't understand to be consistent. If perception occurs over time, and if perception of pictures is an exceptional case, which I'll try to handle, then I don't want to say that invariants are mediating for perception in the same way that sense data or sensations used to be. So much difference between detecting an invariant along with the detecting of the change that goes along with it. So the detecting of non-change in a flow of change, if they are correlative and parallel, is not analogous to the mediation, mediating function of sensations.
Let's see. One last sort of sub-point under the question, and then pass from it for the moment. It bothered me, even in reading the papers, that your answer to that question, as I read it in your writing, was to appeal to this as an ongoing process through time, when it seemed to me that was really extraneous to whether it was realism or not. And that's the puzzle that still remains for me. I would have thought that was a puzzle about intermediate, whether that's through time or not, versus direct, which I don't see as a temporal problem. So that's my puzzle that still remains. Third question, which we were discussing a bit while we had the break, and I'd like just to raise it to see perhaps if others have both the same question or perhaps different answers. The case of the tunnel perception, as evidence for sensationless seeing. And the question that I wanted to raise was, do you distinguish seeing that something is the case from thinking that it's the case or from inferring that it's the case, perhaps having seen something? For example, the hall which you remember and have passed through, do you want to say that you see it now, as you did say, rather than say that knowing what you do by a memory and so on, and seeing what you now do in terms of what, I don't know how to put it, it's unfair to put it this way, visually stimulates you, but given those facts of the present situation, you now judge things about the hall. And, well, indeed, that problem of how much gets shoved into seeing versus something that may involve seeing, but ordinarily we think of it as non-sensuous, just thinking, how one discriminates where you would draw the line, if there is a line to draw, and roughly sort of how much what one sees is a function of what one brings to the seeing is a kind of obvious big corollary problem.
I see the difficulty.
Yeah.
I see the difficulty.
Yeah.
But I think that's one of these cases in which our words get in the way of our theorizing. And the traditional words we have in the dictionary, common speech, for perceiving are happy terms.
Uh-huh.
And I've got to substitute a new set of technical terms with definitions for them. And I don't think, especially for the perceiving of events and motions and changes and transformations, that the words of any language are adequate to describe what we actually perceive. That if we perceive events, but the words we have for events are all mixed up with so-called motions. George Miller, that I mentioned a while ago, has got a paper recently called A Semantic Analysis of English Verbs of Motion. And he gets 300 or 400 verbs of motion and he correlates them and tries to find how they're interrelated. But he assumes that the words are the data, and he never has investigated the actual perception of events the way Bichat did, and I have, and people at Uppsala have, and so on. There are simply no words for the immediate experience, immediate perception. For example, to give you the case of the Uppsala experiments, you see 7 dots on a dark screen. And these 7 dots look like 7 dots. Now they start to move, by and large, in a way that I cannot possibly describe, but maybe I can give you the impression.
Excuse me.
They start to move with swing.
Rough, just to understand, do they physically move or do you see them as moving? I'm not clear what you're describing.
Well, this is a screen, a translucent screen with spots of light on it.
Okay, and now if it's projected, does the projection such that the spots actually change location?
That's
is that
right.
It? Okay,
so. Relative to one another and relative to the frame of the display.
Right, okay.
They start moving. And a lot of these motions are what might be called pendular motions.
Yeah.
That is, one spot goes like that relative to the one above it. What you start to see is a man walking. No question about it. Just 7 spots, that's all. You see a man walking, or you see a man running, or you see a man jumping up and down, or you see a boy and a girl dancing, and you see the style of dancing in which they're doing. Now, there's a recent movie of this, which you can get. It was made by Bernard Johansson at Oslo, and he's been working on this area, as I say. Now there has got to be a set of what relations, that isn't good enough either. But the relations among 7 spots of light is sufficient to specify something as complicated as a man walking or running or jumping or dancing. And that's what I'm talking about. It's not motion, sure, in the Newtonian sense. It's a transformation. And incidentally, it's not just a transformation, because sometimes you only have 6 because one spot goes through another. that sort of thing. Is that an answer?
I don't think so, but maybe I ought to stop. We've used up about 10 minutes. We can pick up more or carry on, whatever you think.
Okay, well, why don't we open it up?
We should decide. Is anybody in charge here?
You are.
You are.
I'll pick you then.
Some psychologists have taken the experiment that you just cited as evidence for the claim that the mind contributes something to perception. Now, how again, do you argue against this view?
Yeah, well, in first place, I don't believe in a mind and a body, and I don't believe in the world anymore.
Okay, well, let's just say something is
added. So the mind can't contribute anything. But I don't even think the brain contributes anything to perception. I'm saying that the perception as such, including visualizing of one thing behind another, is based on these complexes of relations, or the pickup of invariants. So there doesn't need to be any contribution of past experience or of the organizing power of the cortex of the brain or of any other contribution, such as unconscious inference, Helmholtz, or such as judgment, verbal or otherwise. That is, the information's in the light. I have what my wife and I once called a discriminational empiricism, as distinguished from an associational empiricism.
But
the information's all there available.
Can we join forces a bit?
Sure, sure.
I mean, the question which I think motivates each of us is, given a sequential sampling of our visual ambient environment, we come out saying that we see something. Now, how should we take that? One way of taking that is that given what we know and given what we see, this sequential sampling with all the invariant relations we discriminate, we then infer that or judge that or think that, it doesn't have to be verbal, think that such and such is the case, or that it's like a man and woman dancing. Now, why shouldn't we describe those same facts exactly that way rather than describe them your way is the question. I think we're on a similar point.
I guess I see why.
Uh-huh.
I have no refutation. Uh-huh. See, in psychology, we think of that as Helmholtz, unconscious inference. Now, there have been others who've said the same thing. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't possibly disprove Helmholtz. It's not vulnerable to disproof.
There are no experiments, for example, that would distinguish Gibson from Helmholtz?
I don't think so.
Then why should we look at it one way rather than
in that case? It's too general.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's simpler. That is, I think my theory requires fewer assumptions about rational souls or about innate capacities of the mind or about anything except the resonating of a perceptual system to the available invariants in life. Which seems to me a simpler theory than one which postulates either a rational capacity in an innate soul or an innate capacity or a can't or...
May I try one last and I really will shut up for a while? It's right on left. On your view, would it be fair to say the following? Animals and people have concepts you're willing to say. I mean, we talk that way, however that's cashed out. Don't care, no rational souls necessary, however that's cashed out. We think of things having ideas and concepts, okay? Now, we have this sequential input, say you do at this point in your maturation, and given that you see something, fair enough so far. Gosh, now I've shouted so loud, I'm losing my point. Is that whole sequence for you a concept or set of concepts actually being exercised in a scene? For example, is a sequence of knowledge or whatever, perception, discrimination of these invariants actually a concept, literally a concept, there's no inferring going on, so it is a concept which is exercised on that occasion when you see that such and such is the case.
I think so.
Okay,
yes.
Fine.
I think we see concepts. Yeah.
Okay, I really will shut up. Right. Thank you.
Your notion of structure intrigues me somewhat, so I'm going to ask you some questions about that. You first of all talked about structure in the media, and then later on, much later on, you drew the distinction between surface structure and deep structure, after the fashion of Chomsky, I guess. So one question I want to ask is whether or not the structure in the media is surface structure or deep structure.
No, I don't think I said there was structure in the medium.
Or the medium is structure
in the ambient light.
I'm sorry.
At a point of observation.
Oh.
And the ambient light consists of these nested solid angles. You see what I mean?
All right. Well,
we
that,
have a structured array of light. I've got patchwork of sensations, so-called. Except this, I want to say I have a structured patchwork of white and yellow and red and blue and green and so on.
Okay, well,
that's a classical sensation.
Okay, the question is that structure a surface structure or a deep structure?
That's the perspective structure. That's the mere surface structure. That's what we get in a picture.
Okay, so it's surface structure.
Yeah. All now, right. The deep structure consists of what I get when I'm over around,
yeah,
and your head is hidden by his head, right. and you turn around and I see the back of your head, but I still see you, and that sort of thing.
Okay, now for a deeper question. What's the difference between substance and a deep structure and environment?
Between substance, which
yeah,
you talked about very briefly.
Right, I didn't know what you meant, but then you started talking about structures, and you said that they're deep structures, so I'm assuming that you're willing to hypothesize a deep structure in the environment.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I didn't make that clear at all.
You don't want to do that.
I'm. What I'm saying is that the universe for me, the environment as I describe it, does not consist of matter, atoms.
Right.
It consists of substances which reflect light and their surfaces, and then the ambient arrays in the illuminated environment. Now, what I'm saying is we perceive the character of the substances by means of their color and their texture and other such information.
Right.
And we perceive the layout of these surfaces, which specifies a head versus a table, by means of invariants of the same kind.
Okay, do you think substances have a deep structure?
The deep structure is what remains invariant under perspective transformations as you move around.
Okay. Well, I was kind of attracted to equivocating substance with a deep structure, since a substance is something that...
No, I didn't mean that. I meant by substance, it's my substitute for matter.
Oh.
See, solids are substantial, liquids are less substantial, vapors are still less substantial, and so on. That's what I meant by substance. Yeah.
I want to go back to something Clark raised earlier, but it's about the distance, G-scope stuff.
Yeah.
Now, you said at one point, and I think you want to stay fairly literal of this, that perception is always the extraction of invariance. And invariance can only be defined over time. Now, in a G-scope experiment,
I know this was coming up, I know this.
There doesn't seem to be enough time involved. So now, how do we handle that?
That's the worst problem for my whole theory. That's why I haven't got this book written, part. That's why part 5 is going to be on Victoria Media and Perception when it's published. I think I'm going to say that a picture is simply a frozen structure. And a tachistoscope is a device for giving you a flash of structure, which without change in time, which lasts long enough to give us latency and so on. And that even in a short time, or even in a long time as looking at a picture, you can still extract some invariance. And it's So now I just did a kind of extracting of a variance that my wife has been investigating in reading. That is, alphabetic symbols consist not of forms, but of invariant differences between each letter and all the other 26 letters. And if you begin to think about what I call formless invariance, then I think one can reconcile, those are the deep structure, formless invariance, not forms, but the features of changing forms that specify important things, like the letters of the alphabet in relation to one another, or like your face versus his face, or like one animal versus another animal, or like the, or still better, you know, the case of the stickleback, who recognizes her mate because he dances in a certain way.
Well, let me, okay, I think I can get the same thing from this point. Let's see how this one goes. If there were no change over time to specify an invariant, then on your theory, we wouldn't see any.
I can't claim that.
I mean, it would be like living in a gonzo. Right. But now, in the Tikistis topic case, you've got, at one moment, just blank, right? At the next moment, the image, at the next moment, you're going blank again, okay? So now you've got change over there, okay? You've got the change that you need. Can we define the invariant structure somehow in that way? I think that may...
That's what I want to try to do, but I agree it isn't very clear.
Yeah, because you don't have any of those nice perspectival transformations that you've got in the other, you know, kinds of cases, so you can't pick up more and more information, but yet we seem to get quite a lot of information out of that, which on your theory we shouldn't, you know, have in that flash.
The Tikistis goal. No, but to give you an honest answer, I cannot explain perception mediated by a Tikistis goal. But I have decided that I am not going to try to explain all the experimental evidence of experimental psychology. I am going to concentrate on the kind of perception that occurs in life with a moving observer. Now, someday, and there will have to be corollaries added to this theory that will enable me to explain how well we can perceive under Tikistoscopic exposure. But I haven't got a theory. How about that? Gosh,
I know. I don't quite understand why this approach that you have is not dualistic. I understand why it's not mentalistic or behavioralistic. But it seems that when you talk about an observer moving and you talk about ambient light, you're using fundamentally different terms to describe those two. And isn't that dualistic?
Say it again. What are the fundamentally different terms?
The terms which you use to describe the observer, this eye mechanism or whatever, is a localized something that's moving and ambient light. Now, am I not understanding you on that?
Oh, well, I agree there's a difference between the observer and the light that he is surrounded by. And if that's a dualism, then I'm a dualist. But I don't think that's dualism. That's not mind-body or physical-mental dualism. That's not Cartesian.
It is a dualism, that's all I
know. Oh, sure. What I vaguely try to say is the reciprocity of the observer and his environment, each implying the other. I don't think it's not a duality, it's a, I don't know, maybe it's a duality. That's perfectly true. You have the environment, then you have light with information, then you have an observer, and they are related in this way.
I have a very short question. I hope it won't take. Why do you think, as you said at the end of your paper, that the remark that Miller made signals a return to some kind of mentalism?
That's a fair question. Why do I? Well, let's see. I ought to have the quotation here, but I don't. What he said there is experience. What he goes, perception consists of the slicing up, categorizing, cutting up all these operations that we make on experience. And we store these in memory, and that's how we know or perceive. Now, he didn't say experience of the world, perception of the world, he said experience, which goes right back to Descartes, doesn't it? To the realm of experience and the stuff of consciousness and all that sort of thing. That seems to me a mentalism.
Oh, I see. I wouldn't have thought that experience meant that. I would have thought it meant something much more general, just whatever you want to take perception of the world to be. But if that's what you think he meant, I guess it is mentalism. What reason is there to think he meant that, though?
I don't think there's a realm of experience and another realm of physical objects, matter. Experience is always of the world. That's why I mentioned the brain. Perception is of. Experience is always of. It's always an act. Maybe incomplete, but it's a performance.
Just ask that. This leads on something I was wanting to try and clarify a bit. You see, I think I get it right. The contents of consciousness, sensations, and percepts are incidental. The contents of consciousness, sensations and percepts are incidental to perception, I understood you to say.
Yes, sensations are certainly incidental.
Yes, well.
And percepts, if we mean contents, are incidental.
Well, this is what I'm querying, because I'm not quite sure what maybe we're meaning different things by this. But I'm puzzled, you see, to see how perception could occur without what I want to call percepts or contents of consciousness. I mean, what would it be like?
So does Clark, too, I know. He's puzzled by it. How one can have a percept of the environment without having any sensory symptoms.
Yes, so any sensory presentation, if you like, to that way.
Judgments.
No, not judgments.
Oh, not judgments. Well, no. Judgments.
No.
Well, I think that in the case of very naive perception, without any self-conscious attitudes or any introspection or any examination of experience, of consciousness, of awareness, that a man in an emergency detects the affordance of danger. Oh, I'll take a case, my wife's case. You have a 1-year-old baby, and you have what she called an optical cliff, that is to say, a falling off place, dangerous place, except there's a sheet of glass over there, so the baby doesn't really fall off. But the baby will not crawl over the edge, and this is, you can all say, that's innate depth perception, but I don't want to say that. I want to say there is a primitive detection of the affordance of falling off, of a falling off place, of the danger, in short. Without necessarily any sensation, any space perception, or any awareness of the occluding edge, all these complicated describable percepts are not present in a 1-year-old baby. I look at this edge here, and I can see one surface way down below another, and that simply by virtue of the set, by virtue of the layout, the complex arrangement of those surfaces, does in fact specify falling off place. And all the child needs to perceive is the danger, the affordance, without the details of either sensation or of the changing pattern of structure or anything.
Yes, but these are very special cases. You see, I took you to mean that these were incidental to normal perception, what we're doing all the time, not to one of some special cases in which they're incidental, like what babies are supposed to sense, or people, you know, suddenly aware of something they can scarcely see. You see, what I'm getting at is I think there's a certain amount of cross purposes here, because I would regard, you see, the detail that one's aware of when one's aware of these invariants and structured surfaces and so on, all the color and the shape and so on, a kind of sensuous presentation of it, which is how we tell one color from another and so on. That, what I should have thought, why not call contents of consciousness? But what you seem to be battling against, I think, is not how the thing seems to the percipient in this way, but against a theory that things are happening somewhere in the mind, or if there's no mind, somewhere in the brain or something. In other words, it's a theoretical notion about something that's happening that you're against, but it, you see, to me it sounds rather as though you're saying that all we're aware of phenomenally when we look at the world is really incidental.
That's iron. That's, maybe that's too strong a claim, Jared. Is that your point?
Mm.
I think perhaps it is. I do it for dramatic purposes. Now, I only want to say that we should study naive perception instead of analyzed perception. See, I consider my role at Cornell to get rid of Titchener. And to do away with introspection.
Yes,
so. Now, one can with great difficulty. There have been some phenomenologists who say it's possible to introspect on the higher order variables and the meanings and so on. Naive introspection. And I don't know. I sometimes think I can take the attitude of perceiving a falling off place as such, without going into the analytical details of what it consists of. But you're right. The only cases of sensationless perception are rare, at best. So maybe I only do it for theoretical reasons. Yeah, that's your point. Yeah. Or no, you're next, I guess.
Yes, I'm interested in the contribution of the, I don't want to say mental, but I want to say the brain or the species in perception, okay? Now, you made the point that the seven dots is an example of perceptual pickup, okay? And it's enough to specify that it's a human being walking, dancing, whatever it is, all right? Now, the question is, the real question I want to ask is, would another species besides the human being recognize this as a dancing individual? Okay, now the question is further, between members of one species in threat displays or something like that, now is that perception? If that is perception, then why do not other species recognize it?
Because they have perceptual systems in different species at the time of birth, have matured in such a way as to resonate with the information that is important to that species. And the stickleback recognizes a male stickleback by a kind of motion patterns.
Okay, so then the brain does contribute to perception.
That's another issue.
Well, I thought initially it was
the seat of the mind, actually.
Well, maybe the seat of the gene.
The brain is just an organ like the eye. Take out the brain, you're blind. You take out the eye, you're blind. Turn off the light, you're blind. There's nothing special about the brain in this approach. The brain is simply a central organ in a whole circularly organized system that resonates for information.
But the information then is different for different individuals.
Quite different for different individuals, and quite different. That's the information is available. But different species pick up select different parts of the infinite possible information because they're interested in this kind of stuff.
And then how does selection take place?
Partly by internal filtering, but largely by the kind of activity I described. That is, the fish's eyes are designed anatomically to pick up those invariants which are relevant to it, those importances of the world which count for the fish or for the primate. Take redness, for example. My example there is, I'll go back to color for a minute, that the reason why we primates, in this theory, got evolved color vision, some of us, 10% of us don't, but some of us
do, males, is because we lived in trees and bushes and so on, and we found it useful to discriminate ripe from unripe. So the primitive meaning of red and yellow, of the warm colors distinct from the cold colors, green and blue, is ripeness versus unripeness, maybe. So the, all this complex phenomenology of colors may simply come from an evolutionary tendency to notice fruits and vegetations and flowers and fishes, which specify something quite meaningful in the world, and that we ought to get back to that. Now to me, now that I've got this idea, to me red does look, doesn't look warm anymore, red looks ripe.
I'll introduce you to the black person.
I've never seen a coffee tree. The focus of reciprocity between the observer and the environment. And I was wondering if you would distinguish your view of this reciprocity from that of the transactionalists.
From that of whom?
The transactional psychologist.
Oh!
I said yes. Yes.
Very much so.
Okay, I'll explain to me.
But not from that of the phenomenologists or the existentialists, if I understand them, which I'm not sure I do. But the interactionists. That theory of the psychologist, forget it. The theory that the organism and the environment interact upon one another seems to me to be muddled and misguided. An organism acts upon its environment by changing, building shelters and things of that sort. The environment acts upon the organism, but in an entirely different way. So I don't think of my reciprocity in terms of interaction between two entities. Reciprocity is simply a logical matter of each employing the other. That isn't. Now I shouldn't have. What did you mean by interactionism?
I said transactional.
What do you mean by whose particular doctrine do you mean that?
George Herbert Mead.
I think of his character.
It's phenomenal. I come from a communication theory background, and so not philosophy. So we call them transactionalists in where I live.
Well, I'm thinking of that character at Columbia and that psychologist who worked with him.
You're thinking of symbolic interactionism.
We're not communicating.
Okay.
Yes, George Herbert Mead, I remember vaguely, he had some good ideas. But I've forgotten them.
Well, yours sounded a lot like his.
Oh, great.
All right.
I'm glad to hear that. Yeah.
Your resurrection of the optics of Euclid, other people with the visual cone, the visual pyramid, whatever you will. I take it what you're saying is that in moving about the environment with that visual cone, if you will, picking up.
It was supposed to be a cone for each object in the world, according to Euclid.
Okay, well, your nesting cones, whatever you will.
Yeah. Hmm?
The cone goes so, huh?
Yeah. Point at the eye, base on
and,
the object.
And you can make a cone for each object in the world, depending upon how narrow you want to make it within the cone, within a larger cone that picks up your heaven and earth and all that. Huh? I take it that the moving around, produces patterns within cones. The reversibility business produces patterns within cones, within cones, within cones, however the hell you want to go with it. Hmm? Now, what is it on your theory that produces, double quote, sufficient memory that if the cone is the thing, and you don't want to specify either end of it, and you want to talk about a system, the system has got to include memory, I take it, somewhere along the line, so that the pattern invariance, cones within cones, however it goes, the pattern invariance gets sufficiently etched that you're not simply having a snapshot, which might even be cones within cones as well. Am I communicating at all? I take it part of the deep structure idea in connection with the cone thing is that this time around, as I look low back here, is it blackboard or green board? And I could walk around the damn thing, and it would fit into a pattern of cutting a different way, cones within cones. So that I've got blackboard next time around, and I've not just got however it goes. I've not just got a random set of snapshots unconnected.
Can I be more explicit about this so that I can understand?
Be much more so, please.
There is a rectangular surface in the world, and it's rigid and it stays rectangular. It's got right angles and it has constant dimensions and so on. Now, as I walk around, let's see, right here, I get a rectangular retinal image, so-called. Or what I want to call, I don't want to say I get a rectangular optical pyramid, solid angle.
Sure.
The perception of a rectangular object is easy in that case. But this happens to be the only point at which that will be rectangular. At all other points of observation, it'll be a trapezoid. Now, the family of perspective transformations, all of which but one are trapezoidal, and which as a limit come to a line by foreshortening, contains the invariant information to specify a rectangular blackboard or green board. That's my whole point. And the transformations, perspective transformations and the foreshortenings and the minification when I move back and the magnification when I move forward, specify my locomotion. Now that's what I really meant.
How then, on this, if I can get where I think Bob Turnbull was going, how then, when you move around the thing and you've got that, and then you come back, reverse your thing, do you know you have the same thing again without memory?
I don't think you have to know.
Or how are you aware? I mean, you'll see the same thing.
Wow, if you will allow me, perception over time is something I said. If you will allow me to assume that I've got a system here, I don't know how the system works, but it doesn't work by storing up images or memories, such that if there are the cross ratios that are the same and the rectilinearity is invariant and certain other features of that family of transformations are invariant, then that fact specifies the invariant object.
Right, so in that case we can get that in both cases we're seeing a rectangle of the same shape and all of that. How do you get the sameness? That is, how do you get it's the same one you saw before? Recognition.
I thought I eliminated that problem.
Have you just...
See, recognition implies, the theory of recognition which says the present sensation gets up to the brain, makes contact with the trace of the previous sensations, and only then constructs a rectangular blackboard. Problem of size constants and shape constants.
Right, yeah, no, I'm sorry, I think we're missing each other. The point is this, look, on your theory, we walk in here and all of a sudden when we're looking straight onto this, we're resonating to this rectangular bit of information, right? Now, that's fine, let's go out, we come in again. Again, we're in the same position, we're resonating to a rectangular bit of information. Now, without memory, how do we know it's the same rectangle as it was the first time? Right? I've got this, we got the rectangles in both cases, and you accounted for that. All right. But I mean, if I give you images and that with faces, how do we get the same face?
Which, to give you a radical answer, it's in the light, not in the brain.
then, yeah, that's exactly the question. I wanted to elicit that kind of response. And let me put it even more specifically. What you do is, instead of having the stored information, as it were, you know, in the brain or somewhere along the line, the stored information, to put things very misleadingly, is right there in the visual tone transformation by resonance, the whole bit.
That's very odd, because the second time, it's got to be different information than the first, because the second time you not only see it, but see it as the same. So if it's a...
Are you talking about coming back the next day and seeing this blackboard and saying, oh yes, sorry, that's the same blackboard I saw yesterday? Or are you talking about just going barely to the edge of the row, in which case the blackboard becomes a line and it comes back into order and shape again through all the trapezoid families? The identity in that temporal series is easy to specify.
Yeah, because then you have the continuity.
Yeah, because then I have
continuity. Yeah. We want a broken sequence.
Yeah. But now either go into the next room or come back the next day.
Right. Now I have to add, that's what I was trying to do. I've got a whole chapter I'm trying to write in this right now. I have to add the hypothesis of the transitions between vistas as another kind of continuity. Look, you see, I want to say, Kafka said he could perceive the room behind his head. I agree. Phenomenologically, I can perceive the room behind my head. Now, I haven't turned around and looked for several minutes at least. But that is enough continuity, because my head is always moving and getting a sample of this sampled array, which gives me enough continuity so that I can at least visualize the environment behind my head. Now, if you'll allow me that, I want to extend it to moving through the world. And at some point, I'll extend it to a comprehension of the whole environment that I have explored.
Can I push that just a little, too, in the same way? I mean, in the Brentano notion of the act, unintelligible as it may be, there is at least this much going, that by a certain act, allow that to go simply, having these visual stuffings, I can perceive the whole room, including the room behind me. Now, what you want to, I mean, but that act, Brentano, of course, located in the mind, and you want no part of that. What you want to do is to specify my perception of the whole room in terms of continuity of that visual transaction, which you understand in terms of the old-fashioned visual cone. And men of the old-fashioned, forget it, with its nests and other nests, so that I can indeed, even though I'm seeing only part of that blackboard, I might get myself into a situation where continuously, where only part of that blackboard is reflected in the visual, comes through the visual cone, I would nonetheless be seeing the whole blackboard. But the act gets placed now in the visual cone, or if you will, the visual cone, come one end of it and your surfaces.
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't want to put words in your mouth at all.
What I want to do is I'm a perceptual empiricist. I want to extend the notion of perception and take away from the notion of memory.
Why don't we see it at home then, or do we? I mean, you've made this sequence so long, but it allows us to interrupt by going into the other room and back and still seeing. Why don't we see it when we're at home? I mean, that's still just part of the whole vista and the sequences of experiences. Do I then see the blackboard?
I can
at home.
At work, I walk to work, or as I drive sometimes. And in my habitat now, not for the whole environment, not for Columbus, Ohio, but my habitat is one which I can visualize. And that's how a rat can find its way about in a maze.
Visualize is the same as see or not?
It's very close to it. It's almost seeing. I can visualize my house when I am in my office. I can visualize my office when I am in my house. And I say, only to the extent because I have gone from my house to my office, and the opening up and closing in of distance connects up with, by means of invariance, these two places in one concept, if you like, except that it's a kind of visualizing of my habitat. I know what the layout of surfaces is, what the layout of the surfaces are in Ithaca, New York. And I don't have a cognitive map in my brain, as some psychologists and people have suggested. What I have is, over time, an ability to see one thing through another. I can point to my house when I'm in my office because I know it's north. Not because I know it's north in any intellectual, conceptual way, because I know that that is the way to go to my house.
But can you see your wife at the doctoral exam of a student in Ithaca?
Not now, very clearly, no.
You should know what she's asking.
But I can see my wife most of the time. That is, see in a certain extent.
Visualize, yes, but what is she doing?
I don't know.
Yeah.
And my students point out, how do you know your house hasn't burned down?
Yeah.
Last half hour or hour, and I don't, of course.
Yeah, right.
But that's, there are mistakes people can make.
Right.
It's a radical theory of combining visualizing with perceiving so as to make it the common sense assertion true that the purpose of vision is to be aware of or be in touch with or be able to adjust to one's surroundings. And that's what vision has to do for us.
At the end of your paper as well, you also said, you said many times in writing that on your theory, what you have is direct perception of the physical environment. And I was wondering if you could say in a short but succinct and clear way, what makes it direct? Is it simply that there's perception that does not depend for its occurrence on perception of any intermediary or experience, however that's construed, of an intermediary of any sort at all? Or does direct mean something other than that, or that plus something else?
Well, I think that I mean it's direct in the sense that it's not mediated by sense data, in my simple-minded understanding of the sense data controversy.
Is that all that you mean by
that's
saying
really
it's direct?
All that I mean by it. And I mean also that it doesn't require an intellectual process of unconscious inference, for example, as principles, or a process of gestalt organization, or a contribution from the mind or the brain or any of these entities that we have supposed enable us. See, I don't think that information processing, which is the information processing is now the big theory in modern perceptual psychology. But it assumes that what's processed is inputs of the optic nerve or the auditory nerve. And that's what I don't believe.
So you could say that on your view, perception's direct because it's an event that would occur even if there were no occurrence of experiencing a sense datum or a sensation, or the making of an inference, unconscious or otherwise, or the processing of information.
Yeah. That's all I mean. Now, there may be other, there are certainly very complicated hierarchies of process in visual perception.
Yeah.
I've got to admit that.
Sure.
But that's all I mean by direct. And I don't know what direct realism is anymore.
Well, as I see it, that's very close to what some philosophers would call direct perception, and many of those who call themselves direct realists in philosophy would, I should think, accept that as a working concept of direct perception.
That's what I mean.
Do you include as part of your theory of perception the let's say, the end result being that we have some sort of what we would call cognitive notion? I know, would you consider the end of the process of perception something like a cognition? That's a tree, that's a chair, that's a table.
No, that's part of what I, that's part of the, of why it's difficult to understand what I mean. I don't think there is any end process I used to. I mean, everybody, I was taught that the act of perception begins with the object, and then there's light reflected from the object, and then there's an eye, and then there's a lens, and then there's the formation of point-to-point correspondence between the object and the retinal image. Then there's excitation of the rods and cones, and then there's all kinds of processes, you know, on. Then it gets into the brain, and then there's a sensory process in the cortex, and there's an association error. But that was a train of events, causal train of events in perception. And that's just what I'm rejecting. I don't think there's any end to perception.
Would you consider...
The sort of theory I'm implying is that we are in continuous contact with our environment all the time. Even during sleep, there's some sort of contact with the environment. And it raises and lowers as consciousness goes up and down and so on, as attention varies. But there is no end to perception.
Would you consider language understanding and learning part of the perception?
Oh, language is an entirely different problem.
It's
just that linguistic cognition now has got a new starting point, if I'm right. And insofar as linguistically mediated knowledge is secondary to direct perception, natural perception, then Chomsky needs to start out on a fresh set of assumptions. But I do think linguistically mediated knowledge is a separate problem from natural perception.
Maybe one more question.
Well, there's one back there.
At the risk of changing subject, early, I think I heard you throw out Mueller and Wundt directly, and by inference, Gelbart, which is okay. I think I heard you throw out eye as camera, which
the eye as a camera, yes.
Which pleases me. But I have a particular problem. I'm interested in oral perception, and particularly the oral perception of music. Now, you said you wanted to substitute looking for seeing and listening for hearing. So my question is, would you be willing to speculate a little bit about oral perception, particularly music, in terms of your theory?
I don't know very much about audition, is the trouble.
Well, we're 10 times as ignorant of visual perception as we are of oral perception because we study it 10 times as much.
Well, it is sad, you know, it's sad that vision is a space sense and hearing is a time sense, and that's a lot of, that's not true at all. Because, let's see, there's always a flow. We are embedded in a flowing sea of energy. We live in a flowing sea of energy in the environment, including acoustical energy as well as visual, optical, radiant energy. And we perceive both the changes and the non-changes. And that's true for either the flow of sound at the ears or the flow of changing light at the eyes. And I think there is more similarity between auditory perception and visual perception than a lot of people recognize if you accept this set of assumptions. And that's about as... Oh, and one other thing, I agree thoroughly with Chomsky's idea that the comprehension of structure is what is important, both in vision and in speech comprehension.
But you spoke of speech a little bit ago in response to his question as a mediating kind of thing.
Yes.
But maybe music is direct because it isn't referential.
I'm really talking about the perception of events in the world by the auditory system.
Okay.
That is, psycholinguists, seems to me, haven't investigated sufficiently. the perception of events like rolling, scratching, rubbing, pounding, the whistling of the wind, the natural sounds of the world, which are very, very rich, and from which these vocal flow is only a special form produced by this gadget here. So there's a lot in common, but that we ought to, I would say that as auditory psychologists, what we ought to do is begin, we forget about frequency, intensity, and timbre, the so-called sensations of hearing. Forget about it.
We have
absolutely nothing to do with the perceiving of events, including these articulated auditory speech events. And that maybe then we'll begin to understand invariance. That's best I can do.
I think we'll call a halt to the proceedings now. If anybody is interested, if everybody is amenable, we'll be going out for a small drink, probably at the Blue Danube, since it's the only place within 5 miles that you can hear. Thank you very much.